Yes, this is the special class that we hold every now and again to do with Unit 14, which is the special integration experiences of discovering Buddhism. So that's not actually a unit that we do because it's all the things that we kind of start doing whilst we're doing the other units. And so really what today is about, the first step is how to take the Buddhist teachings and bring them into our experience, into lived experience. And so luckily there's a system to be able to do that. So I thought I'd introduce you to that today. And then when we start back again next year, 2026, with Eddie, the unit is establishing a daily practice. So that'll go into it in depth, but this kind of gives you the overview of it and also how to integrate all of the topics that we've been doing for discovering Buddhism. So how to put it all together. And let's start with just a really short motivation and our nine-round breathing. Has anyone not done the nine-round breathing before? You're familiar with the nine-round breathing? No, not sure. Okay. So it's a really nice short meditation to be able to kind of focus and stabilize our mind. So let's just adjust our posture first. The two-point posture is straightening your spine, and then once your spine is straight and stable, then relaxing your body so that your body feels well supported by your spine and can relax. And you can imagine a thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body, out through the crown of your head, so that just naturally your posture becomes aligned. And the nine-round breathing, three lots of three. And mostly focused in imagination. So first off, imagine that you're breathing out through the left nostril and you're breathing out black smoke. And what you're breathing out is all the disturbances and confusion and disturbing emotions in the form of black smoke. And it's such a pleasure to release all of that. And as you breathe in, imagine breathing in through your right nostril, golden light that floods through your whole system, illuminating your mind, energizing your body. So three long, leisurely breaths out through the left nostril and in through the right, and then just breathing normally and naturally. And when you've completed the first three, then the next three, simply swap the nostrils over. This time, imagine breathing out through the right nostril, releasing all of the disturbing emotions, the confusion, the negativities in the form of black smoke. And all of that negativity leaves your body. The black smoke just disappears into space. And then as you breathe in into that vacuum, the radiant golden light, all of the enlightened qualities, those qualities that you wish to develop, flood into you. Your body becomes incredibly light and energized. So, again, three times with the nostrils swapped over. And then for the final three, breathing out through both nostrils. And as you breathe out, the smoke becomes less dense as you breathe out even the subtle negativities. doubts, worries, anxieties, confusion, fuzzy headedness, tiredness, all in the form of kind of mist. Again, releasing all of that inner obstruction. And as you breathe in through both nostrils, the golden light flows through you. Your mind becomes incredibly blissful and clear, and your body energized. So through both nostrils, three times. And then just for a few breaths, breathing that clarity in and out, the radiant clarity. And now that your mind is relaxed and clear, then contemplating the prayer to generate bodhicitta as a way of gently focusing our motivation. So thinking, with a wish to free all beings, we shall always go for refuge to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha until we reach full enlightenment. Inspired by wisdom and compassion, today in the Buddha's presence, we generate the mind of full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. And for as long as space remains and as long as sentient beings remain, until then may we too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So with this motivation, then we can bring your focus back to the room. And let's see what we're going to attempt to cover today. It's about putting it all together. Because discovering Buddhism, it's a three-year course, the way that we do it. Some centers squish it into 2 years if you do it over weekends. But how to actually integrate all of these teachings. So one thing to really get an idea of what's the point of doing all of this, and the point is that we generate realizations. So when we say realizations in the mind, what that means is realizations in the heart, that our heart changes. That our heartfelt experience of ourselves and the world and our relationships changes. That's the point, that we are changed as human beings. So it's not just the head, the academic learning, but it's really ourselves as human beings changing. Part of this then is we've got to figure out, well, how can we trust our realizations? How do we know that what we have is a realization? How do we know if we're getting off track or not? And luckily for us, there are systematic steps how to generate realizations. It's not just a random thing. It's not just something that you hope will happen, that maybe you'll have an epiphany one day, you see other people have a realization and they're crying and they're like, oh, I wish I could have that. No, 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 there's steps, there's systematic steps to generate realizations. It's not haphazard, and we don't have to wait. It's a cause and effect thing. And it's much more than an occasional epiphany. Part of how to do that is the practice prescription. And so that's combining reflection and study. And so when we meditate on the topics of the Lam Rim, there's levels to it. First, we kind of read and research. Come to classes, read books, then we start reflecting, and that can be in meditation and it can also be in conversations, like how next week when we're going to do the afflictions to perfections game, that's like a really full-on reflection, isn't it? Because we've got to really make our mind work, but it's got to be more than just intellect. And then finally, the third level, so read, reflect, and then familiarize. And so that means that our mind becomes more familiar with the LAMRIM response to things than our ordinary habitual response. So that's like retraining our whole experience, our whole way that we respond to the world. So to do that, we've got to take medicine daily. It's not that you get the prescription, you go, hey, everybody, look at my beautiful collection of prescriptions. It's like you've got to go get it filled, and then what do you can't take the whole bottle all at once, can you? You can't just go, I'll just blitz it over the Christmas, New Year retreat, and then the rest of the time I'll just admire all of my prescriptions. No, we've got to do it every single day. We've got to literally internalize the medicine. Make it part of our life, like food. And so part of that is Rinpoche's method to transform a suffering life into happiness, including enlightenment, with the blessing of the speech and daily mantras. So this is going to be the main topic for next year's unit. So we'll go right, Eddie will go right in depth into it. But if you wanted to take this home with you today and start just doing it as a practice over the holidays, it'll be fantastic. So Rinpoche put together this practice for us that is a prescription. It's a practice prescription, what to do every day. And then my favourite bit, we can make it easy for ourselves. So it doesn't have to be a hard slog where you just like pushing the proverbial uphill. Actually, we can encourage favourable conditions in our practice, so that realizations can come easily and well, and so that we enjoy our practice. I think that's really key, because if we're not enjoying the Dharma, I mean, there's a big difference between when problems happen and things are really difficult and we either collapse or we have confidence to get through it because we have the tools. So it's, you can even relish the problems then. And the rest of the time, when there's not huge manifest problems, you can be enjoying your practice. There are specific things that we can do to make it more likely that we have realizations, that the teaching actually enters into our heart. There are specific things that we can do to make sure that we don't get off track and distracted, because, and one of them, of course, is just constancy. Because as you know, once you stop coming to class, you blink and several years have gone by, haven't they? I mean, that's happened to me. It's shocking how easy it is to get off track and how fast. So there are things that we can do to make things more favourable. And that means that we don't, if we're getting stuck, it's not just a matter of just trying harder. There are things that we can do that makes it easier for us and brings back the joy into practice, that can give us a boost, as Geshe Zopa often says. So we've been talking about realizations. What are realizations? What do you reckon realizations are? Anybody got an idea? Like, yeah.
It's just like when the light bulb
goes on. Light bulb goes on.
It's just like,
and then, so you gave up intoxicants almost overnight. Yeah. And but what was that in a teaching,
yeah,
or
it was from a teaching?
It was from a teaching.
Yeah, it was, I was in a
class. Oh yeah, that's right. Oh, yes, Buddhists don't come to places where there's smoke and alcohol and
yeah, and I just went.
And you had, was it a course that you were doing? Yeah,
yeah,
so a DB course, right? And then it came to that.
Back.
Yep. And that, so your behaviour changed.
Anymore. So yeah, that's
solidified. Yeah. Okay. And so never been tempted again?
Oh
yeah, yeah, that's right. So if you fall down,
yeah,
hand back your vow, or and yeah, so once you put on the line like that, it's like, do I really want to hand back my vow?
I was just like, I don't want to say that to Geshe because she's staring. I was just like, no, I can't do that. And I just gave
yeah.
up instantly.
Yeah. Again, yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
and that's
totally
the strength
that.
Of
yeah.
guru devotion when
yeah.
you think, I couldn't put my guru through
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Yes. Fantastic. Okay. So anyone else, any idea what? Yes, Demi.
Online, Esther said that nothing is constant and everything is changing and that everybody wants to be happy.
Right. So how is that a realization? So have a think about that. Because the function, try and think of the function of a realization. What does it do to us or for us? Yeah, Susie. Aha. Okay, so realization that you're on the right path because you've come from a Christian background? Yeah. And there's a lot of similarities between Jesus' life and the Buddha's life, in particular taking those existing teachings of the time and bringing them within. So both the Buddha and Jesus did that, really similar kind of approach. So that's really lovely. So you woke up one morning going, oh, my gosh.
Wow.
So right for you, but it sounds also like a progression, that it's not like you've changed path, but it's a progression to get more deeper into that. Yeah. Anyone? Oh, yeah.
Esther answers to your question that it's to change perspective and aiming to have better intentions and finding happiness in serving others.
Ah, yes. Okay. So to change perspective, that's right. That's getting there. And then better intentions. And what was the last one?
To find happiness in serving others.
Find happiness in serving others. Yep. So that's an aspiration. That's an epiphany. Oh, that's right. But an epiphany, when you realize, oh my gosh, I could die here. Yeah. It's very intense. And actually, I've got an example about this later on in the class, but that's not a realization.
Okay.
So epiphanies are close, but they're not realizations. So if one of the Buddhist ways of talking about realizations is in a couple of ways. One, that a realization is like the spark, which is a bit like an epiphany. And the other is that a realization is like the fire, which is a much more long-term thing. So the spark, that first flash of understanding. And many of us have had that one way or another, whether it's like, oh, my gosh, I'm giving up drinking right now, which I also had a similar one, or whether it's an understanding that somebody who appears angry to us is actually suffering. That's a really big one, isn't it, when you get the flash of that. So that's like the spark, or when you're in teachings with the Geshe's and they, because they have realizations, they say just say a few things and you go, oh, my gosh. And you've heard it 1,000 times before, but when it comes from someone with realizations themselves. So the flash of understanding. But the fire is what comes afterwards and actually burns away our misconceptions, our negativities, our bad habit patterns, so that they're no longer there. So the fire actually comes from practice. So it's when we're doing the common nondros, when we're doing those lower scope practices of the Lam Rim, recognizing our fortunate human rebirth, remembering death and impermanence, starting to put into practice our understanding of karmic cause and effect. So when we start studying those, the fire is when those topics change our behavior. So that's the difference between learning Buddhism in a Dharma center and learning it at uni. Because at uni, you can be incredibly knowledgeable, but there's no emphasis in changing your behavior. The whole point of learning here is to change our behavior, and that's what the fire does. So we need both. We need the spark, but we can't just leave it at that, and we can't think that that's what it is. Actually, it's when we change our behavior. And so it's much more than just coming to a different conclusion or an understanding. It's a complete paradigm shift in our life and a complete change of direction from our ordinary way. We actually start, when you're triggered, this is how you can tell, when you're triggered, your response changes. So your instinctual response completely changes. So what's that point? The whole point here is the main point of this entire class, and actually of all of Discovering Buddhism, positive changes in our mind depend on developing realizations that are experiential awarenesses of inferential cognitions. So I'm going to come back to this definition again and again, because this is what the Buddhist definition of realizations are. They're experiential awarenesses, which means we feel them, of something very specific, inferential cognitions. So it's something that we infer, we understand from inferring it, which means it's below the appearances. It's getting underneath the original appearances and seeing below to a much more honest reality. So for instance, that one of, if you have the understanding that the person showing the angry face to you, that when they're yelling at you and getting in your face and accusing you, what you automatically see is a suffering sentient being. So that's an inferential cognition. It's not obvious. And so, and it's an experience. It's not that you're going, oh, Miffy, remember they're just suffering, and all the time you're going, whoa! That's not what it is. So it's an actual experience of wholeheartedly going, oh my gosh, you poor person, you're suffering so much. An experiential awareness of an inferential cognition. So it's not something that comes naturally. What comes naturally when someone's getting up in your face being all aggressive is to mirror it back. That's the natural thing. The way that we change is through training. It doesn't come naturally. And even parents, which is, you know, where you have to do this or you don't survive, again, there's no training for parents, for one, which is really, really hard. But the incentive is there through the altruism of looking after the child. So that's what gets you through, even the fact that you don't have any training. So how are we going so far? Is it making sense? I mean, this when I first read about this, this is what a realization is, it blew my mind. I mean, because the implications are that so many times, like how His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said that fundamentally we're good. All of those qualities of kindness and compassion are there. They're our fundamental nature. And they're layered on top by all of the pressures and the stresses and the being reactive and the demon of self-cherishing. All of those things are layered on top, but they're not a fundamental part of us. But how do we get that? How do we get those layers off? It's got to be through training. It doesn't happen just by having a good heart and waiting. It comes through training. And the training is by using our logic, an inferential cognition or an inferential understanding. We use our logic again and again and again until we can see the reality underneath the appearance.
I really like your definition, Miffy, because when I first came to Buddhism, I kind of thought like, oh, a realization is you meet this amazing teacher and from the outside he's going to be inspiring or she's going to be inspiring and it's just going to change my life.
And it's going to change my life.
Change from the outside. But having done Buddhism for so long, I've realized that actually the most stable change is what we do little by little over time.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So that's the difference between the spark. We need that spark and then the fire. But what can happen is that we just start relying on having that experience of the spark, of being moved by the teacher. So we go to teachings and we feel great. And this is like the terrible irony of having really amazing teachers like Geshe Tashi Sering, who all the time said, don't come to the teachings because of me, come because of the teachings. But everybody just came because of him. Same with Lama Yeshe as well, because they were moved and inspired. And then when Lama Yeshe passed away, all those people stopped going to teachings. Yeah, because They were heartbroken. Their guru had gone and their source of happiness had disappeared. So that's the terrible drawback of relying on that feeling of the spark that comes from the teachings. We have to internalize that. So how we generate these inferential cognitions or this new understanding comes from repeated reflection, repeated inner conversations, meditations, and on all the different Dharma topics and citing many different examples, having those inner conversations in your mind. And it also means not being satisfied with just the knowledge gained through listening, those inspiring talks, or just through studying and going, oh, yeah, I get it. That's not a realization either. That's like the preliminary. We've actually got to strive to get those, all of that understanding to change our behavior. So even just diligent listening and studying is not enough if we don't become a kinder person. If our wisdom cannot support our open-heartedness. So what happens, and this is really what drove me to put this class together. Growing up in Buddhist centers, there's nothing more disconcerting than to see long-term Buddhists getting more and more cranky or getting really burnt out and stressed the more that they offer service to a Dharma center. So as a child, I just found this is like, this is a huge contradiction happening here. And I decided no matter what, I'm never going to be upset about the Dharma and I'm never going to be upset about volunteering. You've got to find a way to keep your mind happy because that's just not right. But I've seen it again and again. I'm like, why does this happen? How does it happen? Not only that, you know, people volunteering at Dharma centers and getting more and more stressed instead of more and more relaxed. People can come to teachings and get more and more cranky. Really? So that then, that's the other really distressing thing. How can you have really sincere students who study really hard, are very diligent and knowledgeable, and then they just lose it? Get angry, blame others. You know, under pressure, fall apart and just lash out at people. So I've seen that too. Not only have I seen that, I've seen that happening in a Gompa. I'm like, how can this happen? Really close friends of mine. How can, here I was thinking you're a Dharma practitioner. How can you be acting like this? So I couldn't put it together. I just couldn't see how can this someone who's really sincere lose it so badly. And it frightened me because I thought, well, that could happen to me too. If I can't figure this out, that can happen to me. And then once that happens, you know, once that you have that flash of anger and you lose your roots of virtue. So that means, in effect, and this is what I've seen happen, is that really sincere students can no longer access their love of the Dharma. It becomes a grind and they get hard-hearted and judgmental.
Angela said that before when you did the example of the angry yelling person, that the suffering human being is a great example, but turning the mind around doesn't happen overnight.
No, it doesn't happen overnight. And we can't wait for it to happen either. We have to go into like practice mode and practice until it becomes a reality. So that's why it's called an inferential cognition, because that's the practice. You retrain your mind again and again and again, so much so that you actually change. But this only works if you're actually trying to do that. Whereas we can think, if we just think, oh, the realizations are the aha moment, we just study more and more and more and try and understand. Understanding is not it. So the realizations that come from listening, that's a one particular kind of thing, but that's not realizations in the heart. The other thing that happens, of course, is that if we don't integrate the teachings and into our life and change our life, we become burnt out. So that's another thing. People will study really, really hard, and people who go off and do the master's program or study to be a Geshe or something, like Geshe Zopa has been saying, the students that just blitz it, that just study the whole time and they get all their top marks, they're often the ones that after 10 years or so, they just blow a gasket and disrobe, because it's too much study and not enough integration. And he said, actually, the ones that kind of slack off and go and chat to the cook in the kitchen and have a bit of a holiday or get in trouble a bit for mucking up, they're the ones that are actually quite stable and get through and are still Geshe's to this day. Like, really interesting. Yep.
Personally, one thing I use is my yardstick to decide how well I'm doing in the Dharma is how I act towards my family.
Yes.
Because the Demi you see here is quite different from the Demi at home, who has to deal with people, other people that are cohabiting. And so whenever I lose it or the things left on the floor by my kids, I'm like, oh, well, I'm going to get back on the cushion.
That's right.
I've got work to do.
And a yardstick is a very good example, because it is a measured thing.
Yeah.
You can see, well, I'm better at it this year than last year. But hey, thank goodness they're a forgiving family. No, so being a doormat is where you're imposing your academic wishes or understanding on your feelings, but you're not changing your feelings. It's a grit your teeth and bear it thing. So if you're a doormat already, there's something missing, because a realization is completely different from that. It gives you energy. And so much of what we do, especially because we're trying to be good Buddhists, is end up being a doormat and squishing down our emotions rather than changing our emotions. And this is influenced a bit by our Western culture, which says you can't change your emotions. And that's really a fundamental difference with Buddhism. You know, that our Western culture says, oh, well, anger's natural. There's nothing you can do about it. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the Buddha says, anger is a mistaken response and you can do something about it and you can actually eradicate it. So really different paradigm. So I think being a doormat is when you're imposing the what you would like to be, just squishing it onto your feelings and not actually working with those feelings. Okay, so then the Lam Rim. So the Lam Rim is the manual. It's got all the points, but it's not actually how you practice. So don't think, oh, I'll read the Lam Rim and that's how you do the meditation or that's how I put it into practice. It's not. It's the reference manual. How you actually put it into practice is quite different. We have to flesh it out ourselves. So we've got to read commentaries and go to teachings with realized beings, put it into our experience, take all of the neuroscience kind of stuff and put that in there as well. And bring in the human experience. So that's why we have teachers give us commentaries on the Lam Rim, because each person, like what Geshe Zopa says and what Geshe Sherab say, really different experiences of the same topic, and we get this lived experience. You know, how either of them talk about emptiness, really different. So realizations of Lam Rim topics. We develop a wisdom that comes from reflection, which is what you're doing in discovering Buddhism. And that is a different kind of wisdom or a different kind of realization that comes from correct assumptions that arise when you're listening, for instance. So you're listening to teachings and going, oh, yep, 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 I get it. That's different. And if we can't integrate what we're hearing into our life, we run the danger of becoming quite cynical and hard-hearted. And it's important not just to integrate it into our life, but as you hear the teachings, to straight away try and integrate it, to try and change our behavior. How would I apply this? Because if you leave it too long, you just fall into the kind of, it's almost addictive to just learning more and getting better at it and better able to explain things. But you're not changing as a human being. And in a way, that's just adding dharma to your samsaric life. It's not getting rid of our samsaric life. So we don't want to just accumulate knowledge. That's an addiction. We want to reflect on what we've learned so that we change. And the other thing about realizations, like a rule of thumb that we can figure out, is that they don't fade away. So feelings and epiphany, it fades away. And that's why we need to get back to teachings again, to get reinvigorated, to get the spark. But a realization, it doesn't fade away. In fact, it gets stronger. So when we're talking about an experiential awareness of inferential cognitions, that's something that doesn't fade away. It gets stronger as we go on. The feelings, our emotional response, that fades. So based on repeated reflection on Dharma topics again and again. So it's like we're re-brainwashing ourselves, like literally. I remember Geshe Tashi staring off and said, this is real brainwashing. We're washing our brain of all of the negativities. So not knowledge gained through listening or studying, but strive to generate actual realizations in the mind. So how do we put it into practice using your Dharma lenses? So we've got this is just a few of our different responses. So if we've got a problem, how we can apply the Dharma, it's not just, oh, what does the Dharma say? There's different stages, isn't there? There's lower scope, middle scope, higher scope responses. And you should be familiar with all of these topics from various Discovering Buddhism classes. But why we need to be familiar with these topics is so that when problems arise, we've got something to go to and use. And it's not going to be just a blanket, oh, this happens, you do this, because it's going to depend on how much energy you have, on how destroyed you are from the situation. Sometimes all you can do is just hang on for dear life. Other times you've got a bit of reserves. So your response is going to be different. Whatever happens, we have to look at it through a Dharma lens if we want to be free of samsara and become liberated and enlightened. So from the most basic response, for instance, lower scope, the common non-dros, we learn, we remember death and impermanence. So when you've got a problem, what would you say to yourself using that, using impermanence? How would you apply it?
Don't sweat it.
I'm going to be dead soon enough, so don't sweat it. Anyone else do that? I've done that. Yep, what else? How else would you apply impermanence to a problem? What would you say to yourself? Things will change. That's right. I mean, yes, this too shall pass. It's a, even if you feel it never will, just someone even saying that to you helps, doesn't it? Especially with grief. This too will pass. Yep.
Esther said it will go away.
It will go away. How else can we apply impermanence, though? Impermanence and death awareness.
Can you give an example of a problem?
Well, I mean, one thing that we can remember is would I regret this on my deathbed? Or would I regret not doing this on my deathbed? That's a way to figure out if something's important or not, isn't it? The degree of regret. So I, believe it or not, am quite shy, and I've just like forced myself to be outgoing, and I'm still terrified of doing quite a few things. And so then I say to myself, in a year's time, will I regret not doing this? And I think of all the times where I've shut my mouth or I've not done something, and I, to this day, it still smarts. To this day, I wish I had have just had the courage. So I remember that and I got going for it. and often it's things like when we were on pilgrimage just recently, and we're in this temple with a self-arisen Chenrezig that's come out of the rock. It's absolutely mind-blowing, three-dimensional coming out of the rock. Not just coming out this way, but growing, right? So it's a self-arisen emanation. And Geshe Zopa really wanted us to have a moving experience singing some prayers. So he said, got one of the prayers and started singing it, but it was a tune that we didn't know. And so everyone's like wobbling all over the place. And I'm like, I knew Geshe-la wanted us to sing so that everything had come together. And there was Tibetans there, prostrating. And anyway, and then I thought, oh, okay, so there's the nuns there. And usually he'd get the nuns to do the prayers, but now he's in the middle of his tune, and if he asks the nuns, they're going to get all flustered. Oh my God, I don't have the text, what's the tune? And then the whole moment would be ruined. So I thought, I've just got to step in, and at the end of his prayer, I've got to sing it in the English, because it was the Nyungne praise to Chenrezig with the beautiful tune. And I thought, well, that's a bit arsy, isn't it? Like, just step, like, how do you, like, interrupt a Geshe in the middle of all of this? So my heart rate's going, dunk, 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 and I'm like, just, Miffy, just do it. If you can't offer this prayer to Chenrezig now, when it's the time, and serve your guru like this, like, where is your courage? What's the point of your life? And so the moment Geshe-la stopped, then I started singing the prayer. And everybody knew the prayer off by heart, of course. But, of course, I was so nervous that, like, the voice that came out of my mouth, I have no idea, it wasn't my voice, it was somebody else's voice. But we sung prayer and everyone's crying. And then afterwards Geshe-la comes to me and says, thank you, sister, for leading the prayers. Okay, so that was all from this death awareness impermanence, right? So we've got to use it. You've got to use everything that you've got to seize the day. So what else? What about equanimity? How do you use equanimity in a problem? Problem, usually it's relationship problems, isn't it? So how do you use equanimity? Yes.
This person also wants to be happy and not to suffer would be usually where my starting point is.
Yep. So that's the equanimity between oneself and others. Just like me, they too want happiness. Just like me, they don't want to suffer. Yep. What else? Equanimity. How do we do it?
Esther said, my opinion is not better than others.
Oh, yeah. My opinion is not better than others. Yep. Yeah, when you have extreme people, so then that's the equanimity to do with equalizing friend, enemy, stranger. So we have those that we're envious with, angry at, usually people in power, people with money, and they always fall into the enemy category. And then we have the friends, the ones that do what we agree, the politicians that are on our side, all of those kinds of things. There, and then we have all the strangers, everybody else, they don't matter. You know, so how do you, so you equalize those three. So anyone who has a profession has to practice this. That's called professionalism, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's equalizing friend, enemy, stranger right there.
With people like Trump, long story short, I was looking for a new dress for a work party. And then I found myself scrolling and scrolling, couldn't find the right dress, and I was just getting more and more obsessed with it. And then I realized, oh my goodness, all these trillionaires, like, because in the back of my mind, I was, I already have so many dresses. I should just wear one I've already got instead of wasting money. And then I went, all these trillionaires who have so much, they're still not happy.
They're still not happy. And because they still can scroll and get more dresses, they never stop getting them.
And I thought, if this little dress is causing me so much unhappiness, what kind of happiness are they experiencing when they want such big things? And I just, and in that moment, it just kind of made me went, wow, I really feel compassion for
them. Yeah, that's right. It takes the pressure off you and you start having, so that's, as you're thinking that through, that is an inferential cognition. So you're getting an insight into the suffering of billionaires and the tragedy of, whilst you can still fulfill getting more stuff, you'll never realise that that does not satiate you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, so often going back to someone's childhood like that and seeing any so-called evil person, bad person, person we don't agree with as a child, and again, that's an inferential cognition, because you see the man now on the news, it takes a lot to see the child, the abandoned, needy child within.
But straight up.
That's it. So that's changing. So then it changes your instinctual response. And for me, that's my yardstick. Pick a politician, any politician. That's how I can tell how I'm going. Yeah. Okay, what about karma? How do we apply karma? Yeah, so that's combining actually the emptiness and karma. So you've got the dependent arising and emptiness together, and then you've got, therefore, you've got, you can understand karma, and then you've got the formula. You can work with it. Yeah, change your behaviour. So karma has that way of understanding what's happening to us, and that it's interdependent, and therefore we can change it. And just telling ourselves that's quite important, but there's other things that we can do with karma that's much quicker than the analysis, that when something terrible happens to us, we can think that's the paying of a karmic debt. It's over. Fantastic. It's a karmic debt. So that I find really helpful, because then you don't take it personally.
Angela said something similar along those lines. She said instead of blaming, she remembers that she created the causes and conditions for something that has happened to her.
Yep, that's right. So instead of blaming, and even though blame is such an alluring thing to fall into, the moment you do, you lose control. The moment you take a responsibility, then you've actually got control of your destiny. So, yeah. But you can see that is a higher level response. So if someone's just had a really traumatic situation and they're crying and they're in shock, you're not going to talk to them about karma, are you? You're going to go right to the beginning, impermanence, it's okay, it's over. So how we apply the Dharma, we've got to be a bit smart about it, what level. For ourselves too, it's no good beating yourself up about stuff if you're really depleted. Karma and emptiness, they're quite down the track when you've got some resilience. Demi was just talking to me earlier before class, say for Tonglen. Tonglen in particular is really good for if you can't do anything about a situation. And Demi was mentioning, for instance, if you're a carer. If you're a carer, it's full on, it's unremitting, hardly any respite at any time. You've got to work with the situation, and the situation is hard. So that's where Tonglen comes in. So in a way, Tonglen then goes, well, if I can't do anything about it, bring it on. Let's use it. If I'm suffering so much now and I can't do anything about it, bring it on. I remember the wife of one of the really famous Australian rock gods who'd been an alcoholic for many, many years and been quite violent. It was a really difficult relationship. And she was just... she just stood by him the whole time and just said, I love him. I know he's suffering. He can't help it. She just, and it was this inferential cognition. She could see directly to the suffering person, and she just took on, for his sake, all of the abuse and everything. And after, like, I don't know, 30 years, or it was on Australian Story, 30 years or something, he finally gave up drinking, and she was there, and their relationship was good, best friends. Yeah, really amazing. So the whole domestic violence thing, if you have the tools, there's another way to go through it. If you don't have the tools, you have to leave. But here's someone who naturally just did that. I mean, she must have had incredible resources and genuine love for her husband to be able to see. And she took it on happily. Emptiness. So how do you apply emptiness? So you had one, you applied emptiness by working through dependent arising to get to emptiness. But how would we apply emptiness to a situation? You know how people say, well, it's all empty anyway. What does that mean? Uh-huh, Yvette, that's excellent. So someone tries to harm us, which bit are they harming of us? Yes, trying to pinpoint it and it just disappears. Poof, poof. Yep. If I'm suffering, where's the suffering? What's suffering? Which bit? What does it feel like? It just goes, just disappears. Even physical pain can disappear that way. So I've been noticing that at the gym when I'm going doing my exercise. I'm like, well, what is this? Is this pain anyway? I mean, it's just kind of an intense feeling. It's a bit ticklish. Or tiredness. So the whole reason I started being able to go to the gym is that I'm really tired in the afternoon. So I thought, well, I may as well be tired at the gym. Okay, what about Tantra? How do you apply Tantra? The tantric vision. What's the tantric vision? How? By seeing yourself as the deity, how does it transform everything?
The world's just not the same.
The world's not the same.
Nothing's the same. Everything around you is.
How do you know that's not just delusional?
So Esther said, fake it until you make it.
Fake it until you make it, that's right. That is a tried and proven method, isn't it? So with Tantra, you're faking it till you make it. It is delusional, but it could become a valid truth. Whereas getting samsaric happiness, for instance, can never become a valid truth, can never actually achieve that. Whereas we can actually achieve enlightenment. So pretending to be a Buddha until then, yeah, it's delusional, but it's tending towards the truth. And it can become valid, like achieved. Yeah, so when we have a pure vision or a pure point of view, what it means is you're relating to the potential of everybody. You're relating to everyone's qualities. So that's really different from how do we normally relate to people through all of their problems, isn't it? We just go, oh, well, they do this and this and this and this. Is it so easy?
I found over the years it gets easier the more you do Lam Rim meditation, because you have to have that intellectual basis. Then the realize, like, then you're thinking about it over and over again, meditating for Tantra to be successful. So in the beginning, you kind of go, oh, I'll just fake it and you make it, but it doesn't really work because you don't kind of understand what you're faking. But then the more you understand it, you're like, oh, this is what a quality of the Buddha's mind might be like. So what would the world look like if I looked through those glasses? And it gets easier.
It gets easier. And it gets easier because, again, it's inferential cognition, which is the Lam Rim. And that's the beauty of Tantra, that you put it into the practice. You actually practice it. You're living it. So it becomes the other part of that realization, an experiential awareness. So you feel it. Whereas when you're just studying, you're not feeling it.
I sort of feel like if you walk around all the time in a princess outfit, you know, you sort of feel more princessy.
But yeah.
People respond to you like a princess.
Yeah, that's right.
And
yeah.
They're all happy and smiley all of a sudden because you're wearing a princess outfit. It's sort of like a child's play act.
Yeah. Yeah, and play acting is a powerful thing to do. So what we've got to do is play act something that is possible. Whereas normally we play act being a grown up, being a career person, being important, like all of that stuff, but none of that's possible. All of that's just a mirage and dependent on all sorts of factors and totally unstable. Okay, so how to trust realizations. The steps to generating realizations, that's one way. And that means knowing how to actually carry out effective analytical meditation. And what I've noticed, because we're a fairly educated culture, habitually, still, we are under the influence of those worldly concerns. And so, what tends to happen if we're not careful is we use our logic to justify our behavior, or we use our logic to justify our anger, or to justify our resentment. So we use this incredible ability to analyze things to justify a samsaric position, and we just dig ourselves deeper into the hole. And that's kind of a thing that happens naturally. I hear people when they're talking about a problem and they're justifying their position in the problem. They're talking up why they're right and the other person's wrong. And it's like using logic in the service of a worldly concern. It doesn't help us. It's not analysis. So we need to understand the rules of logic and how to actually analyze things. Because if we really applied logic, like you were saying, it changes us. We come to a different conclusion. We don't come to a worldly Dharma conclusion. We come to a conclusion, oh my gosh, they're as important as I am. You know, who am I? Like Esther was saying, my opinions aren't always right. Their opinions aren't always wrong. So I think because we're so kind of educated, we skip over a few parts and we end up just using logic to justify our feelings. And whatever our feelings are, they go up and they go down. They're really inconsistent.
It's almost not even using logic, or it's like we misunderstand logic and then apply a misunderstanding
That's
to logic,
right. We
right? And that's what we
do.
see about so much around what's happening in the world today.
We misunderstand. So the rule, understanding the rules of logic, and this is, it's inescapable. And so what happens experientially is we analyze something, we come to a conclusion, and we go, no. You know, there is no inherent self. So that's a good sign. If you can recognize your feelings that's going no, or getting terrified, emotional vertigo, because your logic has led you to the inescapable conclusion. There's going to be a conflict for a while until you learn to live in this new reality. And we keep on going back to the no bit just through habit. So, first off, we've got to be able to actually stick to the logic, and that is really hard. And I've seen very educated people just like fall off the wagon. They go duh, 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 and then they fall off the wagon. And why they fall off the wagon is because their feelings come up and dominate them, and their feelings go no. So what that means is we've got to get better at recognizing our feelings and not believing what they tell us, just recognizing them as a feeling, as being upset or being scared, and actually having the courage to recognize that and then applying the logic. But if we kind of try and be good, or we don't recognize our feelings of resentment or whatever and try and hide them, they're going to come up and ruin our life. So first off, we've got three levels. First, we have proficiency. And so that's where we actually learn the rules of logic and we apply them, and it's a struggle, but we can do it if we work at it. And that's what we're doing in Discovering Buddhism. You know how to meditate on things and come to a conclusion, and the conclusion is a different one from what we normally do. Then the next stage is effortful. So that's where you do have a change in feeling, but you've got to work at it. So you see Trump and you go through the whole process. Every time you're triggered, you're like, ugh. And then go, hang on a second, you work through it all, it's effortful, and you come out the other end. So it's kind of, it's contrived, but it's correct. But what we're aiming for is something called uncontrived or effortless. And so that's like this lady from Australian Story, that even regardless of how her husband was acting, blind, drunk, abusive, whatever, she just saw straight through to the suffering dear individual that she loved. And she didn't have to reason it through, she just saw it, effortless. And so she had no resentment or fear of living with him. So, yeah, whatever it is that triggers us, that's our yardstick. The things that trigger us often, there's things like being in traffic. That'll trigger a whole lot of things in people, won't it? So we can tell how good our lamb rim realizations are if when we're in traffic, what is triggered is our compassion and patience rather than our reactivity. That's how we can tell if it's working. Parents and children, they're other triggers, aren't they? Yeah. We got Christmas coming up. Big trigger, especially for parental.
Well, just family get together.
Oh, family get togethers. Oh my God. I mean, yeah, it's supposed to be share the love, and how often is it not?
Esther said, I try to see triggers as signs that something is important for me and to review what that important thing is.
Yes, that's right. So something is important. That's getting right down below the worldly kind of concerns response to wherever there is suffering, that's evidence of your Buddha nature trying to burst through. That's something important there. And it's going to hurt until you find the truth in it. So in a way, yeah, triggers show us exactly where to look. So once it becomes effortless and spontaneously and effortlessly, as soon as we are triggered, we have a positive response. So it's just a natural thing. That's the first dawning of spiritual realization. Yeah, it's quite sobering. I find this quite sobering. But at least it gives us something very tangible to work towards. So when I was putting this class together last year, the year before, there was this thing in the news that came up that I thought I'd share with you, because this is like a case study, analysis or insanity. So, again, this was an Australian story. That's just like such a good show for Dharma things, isn't it? So there were these rock climbers and really good friends. They'd been rock climbing for years together. Not sure if they were brothers. No, just really good friends. So one of them's climbing up the rock face and the other one's down the bottom holding the rope, being the – and – as the one's going up the top, his foot slips and these rocks come down. So he yells, rock, you know, because it's going to come down onto the person, his friend. And so the friend, still holding the rope, bent forward so that his head would be out of the way, but the rock came down and hit him on the back. His friend held that rope. He lost consciousness, but he never let go of the rope. The The guy who was climbing, he came down, he injures his leg really badly in the process of coming down, got to his friend, held his friend died in his arms, but basically saved his life by just holding on, you know. The guy that had been climbing, he actually lost the bottom half of his leg, really serious injury. Took him a long time to recover, and on Australian Story it said that, like, it took him a really long time to get back to rock climbing. But of course, what happens in a situation like this was the whole rock climbing community came together and supported him. They grew incredibly close, like losing the best friend like this, dying in his arms. And so then they were just saying, so now he's learnt how to rock climb with a prosthetic leg. Yeah. So what do you think happened here? You know, what in this situation, what do you think was the feeling? What do you think was the realization? What do you think actually happened in this situation? Like that they made this Australian story. What a waste of time rock climbing where you can break. But why do people rock climb anyway? I mean, the thing is that, like, how they said that it took him a long time to get back to rock climbing. You know, it was an incredibly intense experience, and then the whole group came together in support. Yeah.
Esther said the fact that the friend kind of would do the same for me.
Like, yeah. Yeah, that's right. That the friend, you know, gave up his life. I mean, it's a really huge thing that happened. But when I was listening to this, I was thinking, this kind of what you're saying, Yvette, there's something wrong here. Like, what's missing? And we hear this many times, for instance, when there's the floods in New South Wales and people say, we will rebuild. We're not going to let this get us down. And the whole community comes together and they clean it all up and they help rebuild. And how many times has this happened now in northern New South Wales? So now on the news you hear someone say, 3 times we have rebuilt. I just can't do it again. But you have others saying no. So what's happening here?
We're not looking at the root cause, which is let's rebuild somewhere else. And so we avoid the main problem. Like, what? Like, there's not a stepping back of the bigger picture almost to go, like,
close, it's close. Like we're
putting a band-aid on the problem.
So what's happening is this dual thing where you've got this really intense experience, and the intensity and the rawness and the closeness of death, and that you lose your best friend, all of this incredible emotion, it draws you closer together. And you're working altruistically for others. So it's highly meaningful. It draws you closer together. So that's the experiential awareness part, isn't it? Our awareness changes. And it's a profound experience for everyone involved. Like, you can't belittle that in any way. But where's the inferential cognition?
Where's the wisdom? Like,
there's none. There's no wisdom. There's no inferential cognition. There's no analysis. There is only a feeling, and the feeling goes, we're not going to let this get us down. It's going to draw us together. We will rebuild. We'll get back to rock climbing. So there's no actual realization. Yet people say, and in this Australian story too, that there is, you know, a death awareness. Oh, what they got from this was, life is precious and fleeting, so make the most of it. So that's not, it's not an inferential cognition either. It's just a feeling. Life is precious, death is close, and that feeling suddenly becomes part of your consciousness. There's no cognition there.
Almost feels like it's altruistic that everyone's helping each other, that they get wrapped up in the emotion. How different is that from a football game in a way? Like people sort of on that same team, but you know, if they had that same emotion but it was against someone who'd done something wrong, you know,
Well, in a way, I mean, all sports are like this, or extreme sports in particular, it becomes apparent that what you get is this awareness of the fragility of life and this intense experience of being present. But it's not a realization, because what you're missing is the inferential cognition is, well, what do I take from this? So what you take from it is, do it again and again. So the high wire and the bungee jumpings and the everything, do it again and again to get that feeling. So that's where we miss. We think the feeling is the realization. But actually, then every now and again, someone will die. Or they'll be smashed up in a hospital, and the first thing that they say to their wife, usually their wife, is, I am so sorry. The motorbike riders, how many of someone on ambulance UK and Australia, whatever, it's always a smashed up motorbike riders. The partner comes in and they say, I'm sorry. And the partner's like, every time he goes out on that bike, I wonder, will he come home alive or not? And the bike rider also knows that. And then one day, third smash, fourth smash later, they're like, okay, I'll give it up. Then you've got an inferential cognition. So until then, it's just a feeling. And then it wears off, and then they go off and do it again. So in a way, the death awareness of death is certain, its time is uncertain, that comes in. But what they don't have is the Dharma, which is, what helps at the end of life? What can I use my life for? So that's the difference between a worldly view, where you're just being a good human being and having the Dharma, taking the essence of this life. So, as Dharma practitioners, when things happen to us, we can't just leave it at the experience. We've got to apply the Dharma to it. And the conclusion we'll come up with will be really different from everybody else's. So there will be things. I remember one of the directors of one of the New Zealand centres, Philippa, and can't remember his name. So the husband, he was a racing car driver, and they built stupas and this beautiful, incredible centre. And every year, Geshe Tashi Seren will say, "Have you given up racing yet?" And he's like, "No, sorry, I can't." He loved it. But yeah, it's like the inferential cognition was not there. The feeling, oh, life is precious and I'm really close to death, there, but that's not a realization. It's an external thing. So I think what we can do, how do we get out of this? What we need to do is, and this isn't a Buddhist thing, it's just something that I've worked out, is start with your feelings, start with your motivation, and actually look at those feelings and those times where you've had a near-death experience. And write them down, and don't judge them, and don't try and make them fit, and don't try and make them logical. They're feelings. They're not going to be logical. And so then you can have the courage to also write down the things that you're embarrassed about, like, say, resentment towards the guru or being cranky at this or that, all of our failings as well, because they're also feelings. So to just have the courage to bring them out into the open. And in a way, I think the worldly concerns dominate us again, because we don't want to do that. We don't want to be embarrassed about how we feel. So I'll give you an example of something that I'm always embarrassed about. Whenever someone says, oh, this incredible lama is coming to Brisbane, everyone's like, whoa, and I'm like, oh, no. Why? Because I know I have to organize it. So I'm embarrassed that, I mean, and even to the extent of like when someone said, oh, His Holiness the Dalai Lama's coming to Brisbane, I'm like, oh, no. It's terrible, isn't it? But I have to be honest about that, because if I'm not, it goes underground and it sabotages everything that you do. So you just got to be honest about it. And here I am super embarrassed and ashamed and really dismayed at myself. But there it is. And so once you see it, then it doesn't have to dominate you. And then you can start applying all the rest. Asking for help, figuring out, you know, which ways are all of these things. That's right. Yeah. Get with the program. Then you can have your wisdom can support you. But if we don't have the feelings first, we are doomed, because they're going to come up and get us secretly. Yeah.
I found that when you're honest and you acknowledge those yucky feelings that you don't want to have, but you're brave enough to do it, they naturally diffuse anyway, because they don't get bottled up
and then dominate. That's right. Yes. Yeah, so that should give us courage. And again, that's using our logic, we can remember, oh, yeah, that's right. Have courage. Just looking at them will help dissolve them. So then we have the feeling, whatever the feeling is, even if it's a feeling like this with the rock climbing of how important life is, but then we have to use our wisdom. And the Dharma wisdom is something, it's really unique, and it's such an incredible tool. And ordinary people don't have this, so they miss it. So then they go back to rock climbing again, and then his partner's worried every time he's climbing the rock face again. You know, in a way, it's insanity. So Kandralot calls being in tune with reality being honest. And I really like that slant of things, to be honest. Understanding dependent arising and emptiness is an honest mindset. That's how she talks about it. It's really, really nuanced. So what we're doing there is we're using wisdom to help us out of those worldly concerns, rather than using our wisdom and logic to justify our feelings. So how do we put it all into practice? Waking up, meditation, journaling, and a nightly Vajrasattva. So when we wake up, that's the real crucial first few moments of the day before all the conceptuality kicks in. Harness that moment and get used to staying in that moment. Pause as you're opening your eyes before all the concepts come in. Really learn to pause and extend that out before you start labeling things. And then the moment the conceptuality comes sweeping in, then you set your altruistic motivation. The daily meditation. So, I mean, there are many. We do Shakyamuni Buddha meditation. We've been doing our refuge nongdros. That brings the experience, the richness, the feeling. It brings the help. We ask for help from those who can help us, the merit field. I've also found for beginners that when you're doing the Lam Rim analysis, the topics, say, you know, death and impermanence, to use journaling to write it down, because that really helps us stay with the train of logic. Because if we're just sitting there and thinking, it's quite hard to apply our mind that way. If you try and write it down, then you can see, oh, I've missed a step there, or I don't know, and it's really hard. So as a way of a yardstick to be able to focus our mind, it takes effort, but I think it's really worth it. And then at night, Vajrasattva, to purify negativities. But also what it does, it's just like when we go to sleep at night and our brain expels all the toxins. When you do Vajrasattva, you're expelling the toxins, the karmic toxins of the day. It just makes you better. Then a few ways to make it easy. Favourable conditions. Because all of this talk about experiential awarenesses of inferential cognition, it's hard work, isn't it? It's really hard work. We're going to put this into practice. So how do we make it easy? Number one, purification. So what are all the ways that we can purify? What are the practices? Four opponent powers. I'll take a fifth. Maybe that's the purification. Yep, the four opponent powers.
Vajrasattva, 35 Buddhas.
Even just Tonglen can do it, or even just reciting mantra.
Tonglen, reciting mantras. What else? That's part of one of the four opponent powers. So part of the Discovering Buddhism integration activities are things like taking precepts for 24 hours. You do that on the holy days or on the anniversary of Guru's birth or passing away. Go vegetarian for a day. Nyungnays. Sutra recitations. Did anyone here come to the Sangata Sutra recitation? We had like 18 people and it was amazing. It was just dynamite. It's such a moving thing. So purification is like the weeding. It gets rid of the noxious stuff, makes us feel better, clean. Accumulating merit, how can we do that? What are some surefire ways of accumulating merit? Putting petrol in the tank.
Rejoicing.
Yes, that's right. So before you start any practice, oh my God, I've got to do my practice. Go, wow, how lucky am I to have a practice? Even if I stuff it up, doesn't matter how fortunate I am to have it. Rejoicing, yeah.
And actually, on that note, last week when I was sick, I was really devastated because I was like, oh no, it's a holy day, I can't do practice. And I was about to get down at dumps and I went, oh, hold on, I can just rejoice because millions of Buddhas are practicing. And that's literally why I did the whole day. And I was
just
fine.
Oh, there you go. So just, yeah, rejoicing. And see, makes it easy for us because rejoicing is happiness making, isn't it? And we need happiness on the path or we'll fall off, we'll fall down. So, yeah, accumulating merit, rejoicing, spot on. Yep. Then making all sorts of offerings to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Making offerings, giving back your time, volunteering, giving back to your family, all sorts of things like that. Yep.
I even do it before I go to work. Like I'll go, oh, I'm not going to work for me. I'm going to work to repay the kindness of my mothers. And that completely changes your whole workday. And it doesn't change your routine. It's just that you just added a few moments and you changed your intention. So,
yeah. So then remembering that, then that becomes then a realization because you're getting the proof. You're getting biofeedback about it. And so then it becomes part of your way of being. Yep. Doing retreats. Sometimes in Buddhism, the retreats are called the approach. It's interesting, isn't it? So we call it a retreat from samsara. But often that's called the approach practice, approaching the deity. So nice, isn't it? But that kind of group practice or concerted effort, it boosts us. It's really hard to get ourselves started. You know, you need to have either a retreat that you do that over a certain amount of time that really, you know, it's got to dominate your entire experience. And doing group retreats, then you get the energy of everybody else and you get being in the holy place as well, the blessings of the holy place. So it's a way of boosting or supercharging your practice. So if you're just pottering along, that's okay. But every now and again, try and do a retreat to infuse the energy again, because otherwise we just plot it down, you know. Which leads to pilgrimage. So pilgrimage, the blessing of being in holy places. There's nothing like it. It changes your mind. It blesses the chakras in your body, in your subtle body. It's like this parallel universe of like all the holy beings that have been in that place, they're still there. And you physically go there, you get imprinted. So just before we went on pilgrimage to Indonesia, I saw this documentary about the little turtles. When they're born, they hatch out of their eggs in the sand, and then as they waddle down to the ocean, they actually get imprinted magnetically from the ground of where they are. So then they go into the ocean, and then all those years later, they come back to the same spot to lay their eggs. So how come? Because they get imprinted by going. So they say the worst thing that you can do is to pick up a turtle from where it's hatched and put it in the ocean, because it has no way of getting imprinted. So I saw this documentary, and then we went on pilgrimage, and I thought, well, where are the turtles? Where are the turtles in the perfect human rebirth that come up and put their heads through the golden ring? And going on pilgrimage, we're getting imprinted. We're getting imprinted with the steps to enlightenment, so that we, our whole being, our Vajra body, our subtle mind, gets drawn back to the holy places again and again and again. We know where to go. Like, no joke, pilgrimage is a really powerful thing. Having supportive friends, just like Francesca's put into her dedications and pujas now, may we always have the company of like-minded people. It makes a big difference. It makes a big difference. If we can't see it, we can't be it. You know, we need to be able to see how others are acting, then we know what's possible. So to spend time with your guru, following in your guru's footsteps on pilgrimage is one, but also to make sure that you spend time with like-minded people. So important, especially if the rest of your family, you know, is unsure about your journey. Just by you being, you know, a nice, kind person to them, they'll relax. But you, for your own benefit, need to be in a group of people where you can be infused again, rather than having to be the one. Oh, fantastic. A Dharma buddy in the same block of flats. How fortunate is that? Fantastic. Yeah, so I even found just having someone to go to class and back again, like when I was commuting, was really good, just to have, because you'd have the little debrief. And so then finally, just to finish up, years ago, maybe the second last time when Lama Zopa Rinpoche came, and I was sitting there in the teachings up at Chenrezig Institute, I thought, oh my gosh, I've got a question. You know, like, it's so rare to get a question, isn't it? And finally I had a question that I'm like, oh no, I'm going to have to ask the question in front of everybody. So, of course, you know, went through the whole thing of, I've got to ask this question or I'll regret it for the rest of my days. So my question to Rinpoche was, how can you tell the difference whether you're really devoted or whether you're crazy? Because, you know, when you're really devoted, you're putting yourself wholeheartedly in, you're changing, you're in unknown territory. How do you know that you're on the right track and you're not just totally crazy and delusional? Because, yeah, how can you tell? Anyway, it was so nice. He said, oh, good question. I'm like, oh, phew. And the answer just blew my mind, because it was a two-part answer. The first part was, everything arises from the Dharmakaya. Everything is in the nature of the Dharmakaya. And second, check with the Dharma. It was just amazing. It was like, here's the ultimate answer, complete relief. And here's the relative answer, Check with the Dharma. It's perfect. So that's what we do. We apply both of those things. Everything's pure anyway. It rises from the Dharmakaya. It's in the nature of the Dharmakaya. So not to worry. And then in our day-to-day life, how do we check? Well, we check, is there a Dharma precedent? Can I find something in the Dharma? We've got to know where to look. So next year, when you start establishing a daily practice, then it'll be how to actually do these daily practices so that we start integrating and Rinpoche's formula. So I'll just, was there a question? This booklet, Rinpoche named it. He always named things exactly what they were. So they were very long titles. The Method to Transform a Suffering Life into Happiness, Including Enlightenment. It is what it says. So what it is, the first half is Lamrim, the glance meditation Lamrim, which we've been using also in the Refuge Nongdros. It's a really lovely short Lamrim. Everything's in it. And then the second half is the speech blessing. And with the Lamrim, there's also a few verses where the guru enters the heart, and then a few kind of dedication verses, how to dedicate your life to others, that are cherry-picked by Rinpoche from 8 Verses of Thought Transformation and Shantideva's Life of the Bodhisattva. So it's this prescription that Rinpoche put together for us of these verses that help us live in the modern world. So it's all there. And then Rinpoche said, we should do this practice. Like, even if we have high Sirga Tantra commitments and this and that, we should still be doing this practice, because it's the one that will keep us grounded and the realization's coming. So I really took that to heart, and it's been fantastic ever since, both the practice and the speech blessing as well. Because if you're going to go out and if you've got family, if you've got a job, if you go out into the world, you're going to be talking. And that's the main way we connect with others, isn't it? So blessing the speech. Anyway, let's dedicate. Let's let everything settle into our mind. Imagine there's drops of light, like a beautiful, gentle rainfall illuminating the great field of your mind. That everything we've talked about can be the seed of realizations, and we can cultivate and nurture those realizations in the way that we know how, and make a determination that whenever we hear Dharma teachings, to try and put them into practice straight away, that we develop this as a habit so that we're saved from our mind becoming hard-hearted or cynical or burnt out, that we can always enjoy the Dharma, and that the Dharma can be a sure path that leads us quickly to enlightenment, so that we can help all the suffering sentient beings that don't have this opportunity, that don't have the nectar of the Dharma like we do. So dedicate for your own enlightenment, for the benefit of all. Okay, thanks everyone. Next week is Demi leading from afflictions to perfections.
I have my training wheels on.
That's right. And everybody, we all have our training wheels, because that's we'll be able to make some, bring out our inferential cognitions, won't we? Now, if you want copies of this daily practice, and just enjoy looking through it and everything, and then Eddie will explain it next year. We'll go right in depth into it.
The online.